Thank you for listening, and welcome to When Pigs Fly. Talk from the heart, the mind, and the soul. And I'm your host, Andrew Fetter.
Hello, everybody. This is Basma Farhad of the People Speak Radio. Here, when the people speak, we make a difference. Tonight's guest on the People Speak is Jerry Winstrom, a renowned artist and author of The Inspired Heart, An Artist's Journey of Transformation. In his book, Jerry tells the extraordinary story of his daring exploration into the source of his creativity. In the late 70s, when he was a rising star in the New York art world, and when he realized he was too attached to his identity as an artist, he decided to destroy his large body of artwork. He gave away all of his possessions and spent the next 10 years living in the moment on basically nothing, surrender to unconditional trust and the creative inspiration of his heart. Hi, Jerry. How are you? It's wonderful to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here with you all.
To destroy your work, you were about 29 years old when you did that. I can't imagine something like that. I had an incident when I write, and I had an incredibly horrific virus on my computer that almost destroyed all of my writing, and I just thought I was going to lose my mind. But I kind of understand where you came from when you came out of that. It was like, wow, I didn't lose my mind and I didn't die. A lot of my poetry was salvaged, thank goodness, and a lot of it was lost. And some things that I don't know if I even remember I had maybe disappeared. But artwork is so tangible.
Well, yes, and you know, losing your work in an accidental computer break is very different from the way it happened for me. I mean, it was a slow process, and there was something that was very exciting that I was intuiting and sensing, but I couldn't quite, you know, it wasn't quite understood enough, but I was sensing something greater coming through. So in many ways, the destruction wasn't so much a destruction as it was an inspiration for something greater. I sensed that letting it all go would give me what I couldn't arrive at on my own. You know, I think we all come up against a place where with our will, intelligence, and good intentions, we can only go so far. And there's a place where a kind of quantum leap needs to take it further. And that quantum leap is more like a miracle than any kind of accomplishment. So I was sensing that edge of things, and I knew enough about the creative process to know what that stir felt like when it began to move into a creation. And I just felt my whole life had come up against that moment, and so it was very different. You know, it's not like out of the blue you lose your life and your work. It was more like the identity became too small. The vehicle of painting and the way I was doing it became too small.
And so you took it upon yourself to walk into a different way of life and to experience what, Jerry?
Well, for starters, I wouldn't even say I took it upon myself. I really felt that something was coming through that asked everything of me, and it asked to let it all go. You know, I just sensed that was what was calling. So, you know, it's just very different.
Can I ask what you think now as you look back, what that thing was that was calling to you? Can you describe it? Can you tell us how it felt to you?
Well, I mean, what it was transformation. And I don't think, as I said just a moment ago, that we can necessarily get there from here. I think we always come up against a place where something larger kicks in and takes us, carries us in a sense over the gap. you know, I have a quote that I use a lot, which is dear to my heart, which is to set out on any holy purpose. It's something Yogananda says. To set out on any holy purpose and to die along the way is to succeed. And that's a kind of metaphoric death we always come up against when we've done our very best and, you know, given our all to what it is we believe in. There is a kind of death that has to happen, and it's indistinguishable from death. I mean, it feels like the loss of, at some level, of everything that we most identify with. And that metaphoric death is in all spiritual traditions. I mean, you know, if we could get, in a certain sense, to heaven by our, you know, by what we had available alone, then we wouldn't need the mystery to carry us over that leap. But I think that's the way it is.
I love the way you put the book together. It's more, I mean, literally every single story, and that's how you did it in stories, is an individual, almost seems like a layer of your life.
Yes. Well, I mean, there's so many things we can write about. I feel like the way I felt moved to create the book, you know, and I've never written anything before. I was approached by a publisher and asked to write a book, and I said, sure. I mean, it just felt like the next thing to do in my life. I was getting tired of telling my own story to the many people who were in our lives, and the book felt like the next step. And so, you know, in many ways, so the book, the story form, they were stories about the place where I came up against the limitation I spoke of earlier, that place where all may be lost here, and yet the place, it's also the place of surrender, that it was, and the ability to do that was struck in the initial leap into the emptiness by letting it all go. And that reoccurring surrender would happen, and those stories are the places where there was no way to get beyond the moment in each of those stories except to have that next miracle, in a sense, carry it beyond the literal. And so I felt like, you know, that's the way it happened. That's the way, it wasn't me in power. It was me, in some ways, giving myself to a larger mystery that knew much better than I how to make life work, and that's how I survived, against the odds, for sure.
Make life work. Healing the bloodline. Healing the family bloodline is the most important work we can do as individuals. Patricia and Macy and the Contemporary Native American Teachers, that's a quote from your book. And I found that to be so fascinating. The work is very similar to Dr. John Bradshaw's work on family secrets. And what I saw was the emergence of this shadow that held you captive, the shadow of your bloodline. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yes, I mean, I love what Robert Bly says. He says, beware of the man who thinks he had a happy childhood. And I think the message in that rather comical statement is that, you know, even in the best case scenario, we all have a family shadow. And I think mine may have been a little thicker than a lot of people's. But there's something that, you know, in our evolution, in our personal growth, where we're going to have to confront that shadow. You know, there's something that we inherit that isn't necessarily even conscious. It certainly wasn't in my case. I mean, there was just this epiphany I had that I had recreated my father's life. And so in some way, my father always had power over me because he knew where I was going and where I was coming from before I did, and he was trapped in it himself because he hadn't done his personal work. So naturally and unconsciously, the shadow just got passed on, and then it was my turn to either fix it or pass it on to the next generation. And so I think part of that ultimate surrender, when I let it all go and I just trusted completely the universe to guide and have my life unfold in the best way possible. It was only natural that the family shadow was the first thing to come up. And the story you mentioned, I mean, that's probably one of the more bizarre stories in my book, and it was completely bizarre to me, but it was also completely true and completely liberating. And I think that's the way, that's why I call it a quantum leap, because, you know, when healing comes in that, at that level, it comes in sideways, unseen, and you never, it's never what one would expect. It's never under one's control in a certain sense. Like if you, you know, I think what we expect that might happen with therapists and all the other things we try, I think ultimate healing can only happen as a complete epiphany and a personal awakening.
Well, again, so much happens to a person as they walk through their life. I remember a meditation group that I was involved with many years ago, and when I read the story on the gift of silence, it reminded me of that. We would walk around. We had an active participation in silence, and I still have the little tag that we wore, and it said in silence. And I just, I love that. It was probably one of the most profound experiences I ever had, was just being in silence.
Well, it was interesting. In fact, I had just this, the last couple of days, there's a feature film being made about my life by a Danish filmmaker, Hans Fabian Willenweber, but he just asked about silence, and I had forgotten the story, so it isn't in my book, but I had just written about that. And so the transition, silence wasn't, in an environment like you described, that could be a really beautiful and at a certain level comforting, safe thing to do, because it's an agreed upon kind of discipline where you all agree to do it in a certain way. For me, I was letting go of things that no longer served the new life I had given myself to. And I found most of my reason for speaking had more to do with fear of emptiness, or, you know, looking, trying to impress or trying to put out our persona, whatever it is. And so for me, silence in the very beginning was quite terrifying, because I just couldn't speak. I would feel the pain of, and it's almost like living a lie to speak when the moment didn't call for it in a certain way. And I was listening so deeply to what the moment called for that, you know, what one might consider normal chatter just no longer worked for me. And I didn't quite know what to do with that silence. All I knew is I couldn't do other than be silent when I was called on to do that, when I felt deeply within myself. And if I spoke and it didn't feel right, it was like literally a painful thing to do. So I think when the gods are on your case, and you know, in the way I had so completely surrendered my life, everything was happening in that way. Everything was up for grabs. I had to like rebuild the foundation of my being from the bottom up. Everything I thought I was and who I thought I was, my identity as an artist, everything else was leaving, and I didn't have any idea what was coming in to fill that emptiness. I mean, and I think that's why it's so much like, you know, what I described as the metaphor of death, because you really don't know. All you see is that which is leaving. You don't see necessarily in the beginning that which is being born. And there's no way to have the new life come in if you're still filled with the old. So the emptying process is first, you know, it just has to happen in that order. It's like an empty hand, you know, you can look at an empty hand and think, you know, oh, there's nothing here, or there's no way to receive if you're holding on to anything, if something is being given.
We have a question from Mike in California, and he asks, what religion or non-religion were you brought up in? And are you into meditation? And when you answered the meditation part, could you please tell us about the tower?
Well, okay, but those are two different worlds. The tower is a new place.
Okay.
I grew up, I mean, I think my family was never very religious. I had a Sicilian mother, Catholic, and so in some way I guess that was our religion, but it wasn't particularly driven in to us. I certainly studied a lot of the mystics, Hindu and otherwise, Zen, and, you know, I studied most of the major religions just on my own reading, and they certainly had an enormous influence on me. But, you know, in the end, I didn't feel like there was any one particular religion that could carry the form, because in many ways, for me, art was my religion. And so here I was giving up my God, which became something of a false God. And so it didn't make any sense to give myself to any other form. It felt like I was seeking refuge to even name the beast. I mean, I think what I felt at the time was there was either a God of everything or a God of nothing. And so what I was looking for is that God in everything, in every moment, in every difficulty, in every challenge, in every terrifying new confrontation with the world. Find that miracle in that moment. And so that's not necessarily a religious experience. It's certainly an experience of faith, because you have to trust something so completely unseen to deliver your salvation in each moment in many ways. So I hope that answers.
Now,
meditation in the tower, you want?
Well,
tower is something.
I know that I had read in the book that you had been into fasting and meditation for many years before you even so I had assumed that the meditation tower came, you know, very shortly after you returned to the world of man and beast.
Well, the tower came about 15 years later, so.
I
and it's
see.
Right here. In fact, I'm looking out the window at it as we speak. You know,
amazing.
It's in my
I'm looking
now,
at the photograph of it.
Yes, if anyone would like to see what we're talking about, it's on our website at handsofalchemy.com. If you look in the sculptures, the tower, I believe, is in that, in with those. Mm-hmm. It's a 40-foot high tower, and we had it blessed by 9 Tibetan lamas that happened to be in the neighborhood, and they came and didn't. They piled in. It's 8-foot square, but it's 40 feet high. And 9 Tibetan lamas.
I love the way you said that.
In.
That happened to be in the neighborhood. I don't recall lately waking up to 9 Tibetan lamas. That's beautiful.
Well, it really literally happened like that. You know, I live near the Whidbey Institute, and I went for a walk. We have trails going from our forest into theirs. And I came over a knoll, and there were 9 Tibetan monks playing soccer in the field. And I had just completed the tower, and my wife was doing Tibetan practice. And I wanted it blessed. I thought, you know, it would be wonderful to get a Tibetan monk to bless it. And so here were 9 of them. It was actually a comical story. I asked if they would come and bless my tower. And only one of them spoke English. And so he basically said, "What's a tower?" And so it's very stupa-like. It looks like a stupa. And I described it as looking very much like a stupa. And they said, "Oh, stupa, stupa." So they went into the house and got a book of silhouettes of stupas. And so I looked through it, and I says, "Well, it's not really like any of those. It's a tower." And then I drew a picture, and it has these jagged edges going up the long roof, which is very church steeple-like. And so they said, "Oh, they look like flames." They said, "Oh, flaming stupa." So they came over the next day, and they did this 45-minute blessing, which is actually in the film. There was the film crew who, the parabola video that you mentioned, the film crew was coming that day, and so if anyone would like to see it, you can actually watch the film on our website as well. and you'll see the 9 Tibetan lamas in the tower doing the blessing.
Well, it's absolutely incredible. But what's even more incredible is your interactive box series. And I have to tell you, Jerry, as I look at the goddess, which is one of the photographs in the book of one of your pieces, and then I go on to look at the other, there is this internal and external world that exists in each of these interactive boxes. They have. Can you tell us how this type of artwork that came after your life had been interrupted, so to speak, and how, in comparison to your original artwork?
Yes. Well, I thought I may never do art again. I was so driven as an artist, and when I let it all go, I mean, doing nothing was the most difficult thing I had ever done. And I thought I would never do art again. And yet, you know, the meaning of sacrifice means to make sacred. And I think when we can put what we love on the altar, the gods are very efficient, you might say, and everything is given back, sanctified. You know, sacrifice means to make sacred. And I feel art coming back in such a simple way was that kind of sanctified return. And so the work I'm doing now, I was painting in the studio. The work I destroyed were paintings. And so the sculptures now, how they came about, I mean, the first one, I saw a sarcophagi in Joseph Campbell's book, I can't remember the name of it now, but there was this beautiful Egyptian sarcophagi, and I thought it was so beautiful, painted inside and out, and so I just thought, well, I'll make one. And it all started there, and then it just took off from there, and I've been making them ever since, and so I have many of them. So that's one way they came about. Another way, my wife was doing these women's spiritual growth groups, and they would do this all-night ritual called the Long Dance that she worked with Elizabeth Cogburn. And so I would be behind this screen, very sheer fabric, doing the drumming for this all-night ritual because it was all women. And so when I would look through the screen after drumming all night, you would get into this incredible ritual space with them. And then the women would, late in the night, the women would get tired. And at one point, these women were all around the room, and all I could see were dark silhouettes around the walls. And I just got hit with the beauty of that image. And at the time, we have a 2,000-square-foot space here. And it was pretty empty at the time. It was very early on. And now that's what the room looks like. They're full of these boxes, the interactive boxes, and they're from 6 to about 9 feet tall. And it's like beings all around the room. So that initial vision, I feel, actually came about. So that's one thing I could say about them. Also, you know, they're very coffin-like, and they're beings inside, and they do ridiculous things, and they dispense gifts, and they do Tibetan chanting. They all do lots of different things. But what I see in retrospect is that in my life, and that's so much of what my book is about, is I walked into my fears as they would come up. I would just, you know, that was the way I found where I needed to be, by walking into my fear and finding liberation in it. And again, those are the stories, the place where you may not survive here, and yet that's where the magic happens. And I see my artwork now as an expression of that, because, like, I had a person come in not long ago, and he's kind of a nervous little guy, and he walks in the studio, and it's they're kind of spooky, and they look very coffin-like, with carved images on the outside, life-size. They look like people standing around. And he says, you know, if someone were not in a very good space, they'd be kind of afraid of this place. And I think in some way that's like, you know, the initial expression of that initial fear. And yet, when you can confront the art piece, they're whimsical, they give you a gift, they do funny things, and you end up actually, you know, receiving something other than that initial hesitation that you might approach it with. So I see them in retrospect as an expression of just the way I have lived my life. And I didn't intend that, but it has become clear over the years that it's just inevitable. I mean, we all, everything we do in some way is expressed in the things we do.
Well, Jerry, they're amazing. For anyone that would like to see some of the work, you can go to www.handsofalchemy.com. Jerry's book, The Inspired Heart, is just amazing and is filled with some of the most incredible stories. And I appreciate your being with us. And before we leave, I'd like to read this from your book. The artist's experiences of living on the edge will expand and challenge your vision of life's possibilities. Travel along in the now as Jerry Winstrom surfs the waves of life and carries the most colorful people with him. Joe Cullen, the publisher of Parabola magazine. And Parabola, thank you, Parabola, because were it not for you, I would not have known about this incredible book. Jerry, this really is a story of transformation. Thank you for being with us on the People Speak Radio Show. And we hope to have you back soon.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Forever Fresh Disposable Undergarments offers a convenient, economic option to men and women who suffer from minor incontinence. Forever Fresh is a patented, internationally award-winning brand that allows the skin to breathe as naturally and comfortably as cotton garments. Environmentally friendly and hypoallergenic, the undergarment features a built-in incontinent pad pocket to be used when extra absorbency is needed. Forever Fresh is available at participating Walgreens. To learn more, you may also visit foreverfresh.com.
Are you appalled that our country is spending billions on war while cutting funds for our libraries, hospitals, and schools? Are you heartsick at the suffering of the Iraqi people? Then join me, Medea Benjamin, in signing Code Pink's urgent call for peace in Iraq. Sign on today at www.womensaynotowar.org.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the World Food Program.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes. All are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Got questions? The library's got answers. And books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
PBSRadio.com. It's not mainstream. It could be here. Information and knowledge bring humanity closer to truth. PBSRadio.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Basma Farhad again for the People Speak Radio. Here, where when the people speak, we make a difference. Not only do we speak these days in Detroit, but we take action. New group. Angelo Henderson is our guest tonight. Angelo is an award-winning Pulitzer Prize writer and journalist, freelance media consultant. Former chapter president and officer of the NABJ, and a broadcast journalist right now here in the metropolitan Detroit area on Radio 1 Detroit, as well as a correspondent for CTN Television Network. Hi, Angelo. How are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm wonderful. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, thank you. Angelo and I were just talking about his mad last dash to the grocery store before the big storm of 211 slams down on the metropolitan Detroit area. Angelo, I want to tell our guests how we met. We had been following as a business and with my partners. Some stories that had happened in the metropolitan Detroit area, the first one being that of a 90-year-old woman last year who was beaten and raped by three young men. That incident inspired a group called the Detroit 300. Now, Detroit 300 is not a vigilante group, but it is an assistant, it is the eyes, and it is the ears of a community that said enough. We're not going to take it anymore. If we can't protect our old people and we can't protect our young people, where do we go from there? Angela, tell us about Raphael and the 300 and how this all came about, please.
Okay. Well, what happened was there was a rape and robbery, as you mentioned, of a 90-year-old woman. And I do talk radio, as you mentioned, on 1200 AM WCHB in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
And that day, the day after the rape was announced, we had callers, we were in. Everybody was just angry. You know, a 90-year-old woman, how could these teenagers, whoever they were, rape a 90-year-old woman? She said she awakened to find, like, this teenager on top of her. After that, they beat her, they threw her on the side of the bed. She laid there for hours. Her grandson happened to come home, stop by there, and found her on the bed, on the side of the bed. Otherwise, she likely would have been there for even hours, if not days. And, you know, so we just say, you know, what happened to community? What happened to the kind of place where we honored seniors? You know, where you went to them for wisdom, and is just sick that someone would find some kind of pleasure or sexual desire with come on. I mean, it's just unbelievable. So the lines were lit up. Everybody was outraged. Well, that night I heard from Raphael B. Johnson, who is a guy who's really, really entrenched in the community. In fact, he's featured oftentimes on Maury Povich, the Maury Povich Show, to help families. He's the one that gets the abuser husband back on the right path, or the out of control kid back in line. They oftentimes use him. He has a company that works in schools, and he helps to transform those kind of those issues. Well, he called me and said, "Angel, I have a I'd love to get 300 men to go out here and look for these punks who raped that woman, these thugs." And I said, "Why don't you come on the show? Why don't you come on the show in the morning, and we'll talk about it, and we'll try to see what we can do." So when we got on, when he came on the show that morning, I mean, I was taking calls, we were talking, and next thing you know, it wasn't just meet Raphael, because that was my initial thought. I'm going to help Raphael get some people there for this thing that he wants to do. But I ended up saying, meet us at 7 o'clock on Leslie and Petowski. We're going to show the Detroit, that enough is enough. And so I don't know how, I just ended up saying we. And next thing you know, Raphael had contacted a guy named Minister Malik Shabazz, who has been community organizing for about 20-plus years. So he had him out there. So when I got finished with work, dropping my son off, in fact, I went and got my son, and I said, you need to come experience this. We're gonna try to do something different instead of just letting these kind of things happen. When I got to Leslie, on the street of Leslie, the corner of Leslie and Petoskey, I couldn't even get close to the corner. There were so many cars. There were so many people. I was like, wow. It was incredible.
This evening somebody had said to me, "Well, what are you going to do? There's nothing you can do." And if you don't have a solution, I said, I may not have the solution, because honestly, I don't know how things like this start. And as you just told the story of how this great neighborhood program started, it reminds me of exactly what's happening all over the world now, in Egypt, everywhere. Nobody knows how these things start. They just are a moment of, that's it. We can't take it anymore. And it happens. And when it happens, it's spontaneous, it's amazing, it's fulfilling. And I know that the Detroit 300 have been instrumental in solving a number of rape cases, 6 or 9, if I'm not mistaken.
Right. There was a serial rapist that had just tortured the east side of Detroit most recently, and the guy was raping women on bus stops, taking them from as they were walking home behind abandoned homes and in abandoned homes, and he was raping them. It got so bad that the city of police, the city of Detroit, worked with the bus system, so that buses would pick people up at actual precincts rather than bus stops. That's how crazy it was. And so, once again, part of our goal of what for Detroit 300, because we work also closely with police, when they're out of answers, they didn't know what to do, we kick in. Because here's the thing, there is a no snitch philosophy in the streets, especially the urban streets. Don't tell cops anything. Well, what we learned from Petowski and Leslie, from the 90-year-old rape, from the rape all the way up to the other cases that we've helped solve, is that people will tell us. It's, because there's a community, there's a sense of community, in fact. And for example, if we're out there passing out flyers, writing down tips, people will say, "Hey, didn't we go to the same barbershop?" Or they'll say, "Or didn't our kids go to school together?" 300-plus guys and women together, they don't know. We're talking to everybody, knocking on doors, people stopping cars. People don't know who you're speaking with, whereas typically it's two detectives in a police car that stop on a block. Everyone sees them get out of the car, watch whose door they knock on. They know how long they stay in there. Our approach being is just the massive numbers and doing it all over the place with cars, knocking on doors and flyers, going into stores, then people are not sure who is telling what. And because of the comfort level, we get information that police are not able to get. And not only do we get it about the crime that we're looking for, the criminal we're looking for, we get it for every other crime. They're selling crack over here. This guy over here has been stealing televisions. And this guy over here has been stealing copper. And, you know, you need to check out this. You need to check out that. So it ends up being almost like a galvanized movement of information that normally that wouldn't be accessible to police. And so, so that's how we fit, and that's where we fit.
Well, Mike in California has a question for you, Angelo. And he said, is your group, Detroit 300, composed of ordinary citizens, and are they vigilante, armed, trained in self-defense? What are the boundaries regarding use of force? And what are the rules that you guys follow?
Right. Well, there is we have a constitutional right to make a citizen's arrest. So we do have that authority, but at the same time, we have police who are traveling with us. We have, it'll be like a couple of police officers among our big group. And if we really need someone to go in and arrest, we have police officers that we can signal that we need their help. And also, too, typically we're in contact with them on the telephones so that they can come in and basically close the deal. We're just trying to find the best information, because you get leads all the time, and we'll go to a house and say, we think the guy over here is John. He fits a description. In fact, I think he has that kind of car. We'll go over there. We'll talk to John. We'll see if he has that kind of car. If he doesn't, we'll look, oh, no, this isn't the guy we're looking for. He doesn't have, for example, bad acne, which was one of the descriptions one of the rape victims gave us. So we'll let him go. Mm-hmm. But when we get something, we can point him to the direction. So we're not vigilantes. We do have people in our group who have CCWs. We do. But we're not trying to use them or anything. Our goal is to get information that could help lead to the arrest of a person. And if we find them, to capture them and hold them until police come.
And is there a certain way that, do you just restrain them physically? Is that how you do that?
Well, typically, because the officer's with us, we don't have to hold them down physically, because usually the officer is there. We can say, hey, this is our guy. He's right here. And they call in troops, and it's done.
Wonderful. You also, there's a new book, I believe, that one of the gentlemen wrote, How to Survive and Take Back Your Neighborhood.
Oh, well, what we're doing is we're putting together a handbook to try to teach communities how to do what we're doing. In fact, we're having a citywide block club event on February the 11th here in Detroit. We're going to teach other community groups, neighborhood groups, church groups, how to patrol, how to do the flyers. We're going to teach them some self-defense techniques. Also, along the way, we've learned a lot. For example, one of the tips that we were given by an officer once was, if you are living alone, for example, one of the biggest deterrents to break-ins are dogs, okay? But say you don't have a dog, still, they suggest get a huge dog bowl, put it in your back, right in your back sliding glass patio door, along with a big bag of dog food, giant bag of dog food. When someone comes around and look and say, should I break in this house? They see that big dog food bag and a big bowl. They think, oh, my God, there's probably a dog in here. I'm going to go to another house. There's all
and
kinds of things.
And the criminals don't like light, as far as I know.
Right.
Turn your lights on.
Yes, keep your lights on, absolutely. But can you imagine going to the back and seeing that big bag of dog food and a big dog bowl? Or they also have these motion... battery-operated motion lights that we've learned about that you can put in abandoned homes. Like if you live next door to a home, and there are a lot of abandoned homes in the city of Detroit, you put these battery-operated motion lights, so if somebody comes in there, you see the light turns on, that's a signal for you. So we're gathering information.
And for people that think that abandoned homes just end up in the inner city, look at how many homes in our neighborhoods have been foreclosed upon. So everybody has abandoned homes, and there is potential for danger for everyone everywhere. You really need to take precautions about things like that. Don't think you'd have to be in the inner city to have any of this stuff happen to you. Angela, let me ask you, hopefully those magnets have helped you guys.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I showed them your I had a surprise. I kept your magnets, the magnets you donated to us, in my coat. And I told them I had a great surprise for them. And when I opened my coat, they just were, oh, my, look at that. I said, they're reflective, you guys. We could put them on each side of our cars, the lead cars, the car that's stopping traffic, as well as the rear car, because we're also on walkie-talkies. If you could imagine, 100-plus cars in one corner, for example, we may stop. We got cars on north side, west side, east side, south side. Now we can have the identification marks so people know who we are. That's the Detroit 300. They are wonderful. We're so excited. In fact, we're going to say thank you to you all at our February 11th event, because that was really a blessing for us, and we really, really appreciate it. So we're going to definitely mention you guys and just thank you publicly for your support and your donation.
Well, I'll tell you, anything that makes our cities safer for our elderly, for our youth, keeps our I think one of the greatest things here that you guys have done as a community is show the youth that you don't have to take it anymore. Just like we don't have to take it, if we can do something, you certainly can do something. I think this is part of the problem that happens in our communities, Angelo, is that everybody seems to have given up. It's like, what's the use? I can't do anything. Of course you can do something. Will it work? We don't know. But how can we lose by trying? And let me ask you something. Has it worked? From my understanding, the violent crime in the neighborhoods that you guys are patrolling has decreased over the last year.
Absolutely. When we started, for example, even on the East Side Rapists, when we hit the streets, the rape stopped. So
well,
while we were looking for them, there was
so
this,
people
wasn't
that
any
think
more rape.
That you can't make
while
a difference
we were
are wrong. People that think you can't make a difference are wrong.
Like I tell people that night, you know, when you have the numbers that we have driving around, passing out flyers, we're on bullhorns saying, you know, you will not, we are going to take our streets back. We're looking for a rapist. This is his age. It's your community. We got to take back the streets. You don't know how many people then did not decide not to carjack somebody, decide not to break into somebody else's home. Our presence alone, just being out in the street with flashlights and people, absolutely changes things. And once again, reminds people that you can make a difference. After the rapist was caught, we drove through some of those neighborhoods with Detroit 300. People were coming out on their porches. They were clapping. They were screaming. They were shouting. It was the same way after we caught the 90-year-old rapist. People were coming out while we were patrolling. And when we did something one time in helping an 86-year-old lady who had been assaulted, she paid two people to rake some leaves for her two guys. They pushed in her house, and then they robbed her, and then they pushed her down the steps and left her for dead. But when we were patrolling at night, people said that they had opened their windows, seniors. They haven't opened their windows in years. They came out and watered their plants at night. Because we were there, we were present, and we were like, take your time. Water your plants. It's okay. It was a sense of satisfaction like never before. Why are we allowed to live just in these environments where we're in prison and we're surrounded by dogs and pit bulls, and it's like they're living and we're in prison?
Angelo, has the group been approached by other cities to help them to set up something like this?
Wow, we have been hit by other cities now. People are saying you got to come to Oakland, California. You got to come to Dallas. You got to come to Houston. You got to Philadelphia. So we are right now trying to get our movement tight, because right now we are taking to yet another level. I'm going to start approaching all the churches in whatever the areas are where a crime takes place. I'm going to pinpoint every church, and I'm going to once again try to ask their men's ministries to come and help us in this movement. So we're galvanizing even more people. And what we want to do is get this model so tight that we can come into it, Oakland, California, and just lay it out and say, this is how you do it. You know, if this is your community, you know, we'll show you. We'll even help kind of guide you. Absolutely, we want to take it to other places. And absolutely, it would work. And I'm telling you, people were looking for solutions. And it's just wonderful when you see, I mean, we have seniors out there. We have young people out. In fact, Raphael one time stopped a whole, in the summer, stopped a whole, about 12 guys playing basketball. He just took the basketball. They're like, what's going on? He's like, look, a 90-year-old grandmother was raped. It could have been your grandmother. What would you think if two teenagers raped and beat up your grandmother? These kids were like, oh, no, that ain't going to happen. I know it ain't going to happen. They're going to do that to my grandmother. They said, this is your grandmother who they did it to. And so they said, why don't you help us? This is your neighborhood. We don't even live here. We're trying to find this guy, and you all playing basketball. You live here. This is your neighborhood. Your grandmother could be next. So you know what they did? They threw down the basketball, and they walked with us.
Well, you know, I think this is a great legacy to take in. For those of you that don't know, this is February. February is Black History Month. And I'll tell you what, Angelo, I've never been prouder of our city, of our state, and how we are handling our issues. We're taking back our neighborhoods. We're greening up. We are expanding. We are retraining our workforce. There are so many ways that the people of Michigan have come together, the metropolitan Detroit area. I'm telling you, today I was watching Egypt, and a young woman said, I was never proud to be an Egyptian until now. I have never been prouder of being a citizen of the state of Michigan than I have these days. And it's people like you, people like Raphael, people like Malik, that inspire people to continue. You have taken the legacy of Black History Month into a new generation. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And if we could bring back hope, you know, because I know typically African American, especially men, are not necessarily portrayed positively in the news. You see them as criminals all the time, or you know, are as thugs, drug dealers. But when you see these guys out here, you know, caring about the community, you know, trying to help the elderly, helping women feel safe. We know that little boys are seeing physically us, men who care about their communities again. And so I say, you know, there's some things we can count, like the number of criminals we help catch. But there's some things that we'll never know the kind of impact we had because someone saw us and saw that we cared. And sometimes it's that simple. You just got to care enough to say, you know, we can't live like this.
Well, thank you, Angelo. I am proud again of the work that you do. I'm glad that we could help in any small way. We look forward to hearing more about the Detroit 300 and the organizers behind it. Have a blessed year. We will keep and hopefully you'll stay safe, and hopefully you'll stay warm, and we'll be able to find the street by the time the event comes around.
That's true. Well, and our website is thedetroit300.org, thedetroit300.org. Thank you again for inviting me on. Thank you for your support. And, you know, and that's the thing. We got to work together, city, suburbs, all racial demographics, young, old, men, women. I mean, it's time for us as a community to say, you know what, it's time for us to live again.
And I'll tell you what, people, I'm putting out the challenge. Let's see if you can do it better than Detroit can, because I don't think it's possible. You guys rock. Thank you, Angelo. Ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Another night of the People Speak Radio. And don't forget, when the people speak, we do make a difference. Good night, everybody. We'll see you next Tuesday.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office of summer people, and they stood there hungry and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.